On ABC Radio,
this is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Good morning, welcome aboard. It's The Big Fish. Great to have your company. Josh Hutchins is trigger happy. How to catch a trigger fish on the fly, our first cast on The Big Fish. How do you catch a trigger fish? I don't know. Outdraw him. Tales of giant 100-pound tarpon and other adventures with the Aussie fly fisher up next on The Big Fish. The Aussie fly fisher Josh Hutchins is really the Harry Potter of Australian fishing. He waves his long wand and it transports him to countries all over the world. G'day, Josh.
G'day, Scott. I've never heard it explained that way, but I'll go with it.
Well, it's true, isn't it, that fishing's opened the door for you for great adventures. Where have you been of late? Oh, there's been a few months since we had a chat.
Yeah, I guess over winter we've been occupying ourselves in some warmer places up north. So we made our way to Florida first, went up to the Icast Fishing Convention, which was a great week, and managed to catch a big tarpon and a few others, which was awesome. Some snook.
Just before you get onto the snook and redfish, what was the tarpon experience like? Because I know we catch plenty of them in the rivers here, the giant herring we call them, and they're nothing like the tarpon in Florida Keys, though, that go hundreds of pounds. Tell us about catching one of the giant ones.
Yeah, that was amazing. So I'd left my house in the Blue Mountains, and 32 hours later I checked into my hotel in Florida, so it was quite a long day. And I was a little bit jet-lagged, nearly got attacked by a Rottweiler on the first morning about 5 a.m. when I went to the service station, so that kind of overcame the jet lag. And 30 minutes later, I caught my first tarpon. It was about 30 pounds, just a little one. And then later on that afternoon, I got one that was around 90 to 100 pounds, and that was just amazing.
You would have caught plenty of our tarpon that look exactly very similar, but aren't nearly as big.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I guess they do look identical in a lot of ways, and they just grow so much bigger over there. And
are they the same fish, or are they a different fish?
They're a slightly different genus of fish, I guess. In a lot of ways they do look similar, but they are different.
We've got so many of them that they just don't get over, I don't know, what would be the biggest 10-pound would be a giant.
Yeah. I mean, other people know more about it than me, but it's just amazing the migration they go on. And obviously in the Florida Keys, those big fish are migrating, and you'll be wading out sort of on a clear patch of beach somewhere, beautiful clear water, white sand, and just suddenly this slow-moving school of could be 80 to 150-pound fish just come rolling up the beach in, I guess, a long string of fish. And, yeah, you're casting quite small flies and small hooks, and, yeah, they're hard to land because they're a big fish, they jump a lot, they're strong, and it really is an ultimate fish. It was an absolutely awesome experience. I went in with the expectation to hopefully catch one in 3 days, and I ended up with six, so I was pretty damn happy.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it? That's just the dream come true. And fish up around the 100-pound mark, the old magic 100-pound mark.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously didn't weigh any. It's long gone are the days where good fishermen, they just don't pull them out of the water these days. You kind of hold him in the water and get your shot there. And
oh, they'd know, though. They'd know what they...
Yeah, the guide estimated my biggest one to be 90 to 100 pounds, so I was pretty happy with that. It was a great moment for sure.
And they release well? Because they can breathe while they fight, can't they? They suck air.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I guess if people pull them up on the boat for too long, they can die, but in Florida there's actually a rule against taking them out of the water for a photo. Anyway, you've got to have them at least in the water a little bit.
Oh, you love that sort of photography anyway. It's such an extra dimension, getting that in the water, out of the water thing. That's been one of your many trademark type shots, so you'd love that.
Yeah, no, I do like that. We, I guess with the tarpon and where we were, it didn't lend itself to amazing photography at the time, and we'd fought it for pretty hard for about 20 minutes. So it was one of those moments where I thought, there's a million photos I want to take, but let's just take a couple and let it go. But I mean, it was a great experience. And I guess this winter too has just been nice to get away to some warmer places. We got away to Christmas Island for a little bit as well, caught some nice bonefish there and triggerfish. I guess I look at Christmas Island as just one of those places that's an extremely good triggerfish fishery. A few GTs obviously getting around there. We got up to Northern Australia in the Wessel Islands. We've been working on an operation up there to book a bunch of clients into, which has been really good for permit. We got 12 nice permit on the last trip, which was very exciting.
Gee, that's a hot spot for them, isn't it? The Wessel Islands.
Yeah. It's just an absolutely beautiful place. And it's a long way. We take a mothership out there and I guess you burn a lot of fuel to get there. And yeah, I mean, Queenies, GTs, Barramundi, permit, plenty of blue bastards. It's an amazing blue bastard fishery, which is a obscurely named fish, but they are a very cool flat fish to chase for a fly fisherman. And it's been nice. Certainly escaped a bit this winter and happy to be into the trout now.
I read Tom McGuane, as you probably do. He's a fabulous fly fishing writer. You know, he's the Ernest Hemingway of fly fishing writers, really. He talks about permit in the Florida Keys and some of those heartbreaking chapters about year after year trying to catch them and people, you know, dying without catching them after spending their lifetime chasing them. What do they say in Florida when you say, look, we just had a trip the other day and we got a dozen?
I mean, I guess you can have good days in Florida too. While I was there, we actually had a quick look for some, and the only time we saw a permit was when we were waiting on some tarpon in 2 metres of water, so it wasn't particularly the right fly fishing water to catch it. But, Florida is just a well-fished location, and those fish are a little bit smarter and they're well aware. And I mean, permit is a permit anywhere in the world. They're not an easy fish to catch. They need a good cast, they need a quick cast, and the fly needs to be doing the right thing. And even then, they'll still reject it a lot of the time. But, when you find those locations like the Wessel Islands, where they just seem to be quite untouched and a little bit more willing, it is a nice feeling.
And what about the Florida permit? Did you try, or won't the tarpon flies work on them?
Yeah, I guess you need a particular crab fly that generally is on the bottom, and the tarpon flies just don't lend themselves to that. The tarpon fly we were using is almost like a trout muddler minnow. It was quite small. I mean, obviously bigger than that. It was a 3-0 hook, but in comparison to the size of that tarpon's mouth and the size of the fly, very small.
He's off to French Polynesia very soon.
Yeah, just packing the bags today, actually. We've been working with a few guys over there with a new operation for particularly bonefish, bluefin trevally, GTs, and yeah, there's a great community of guides over there, and heading over there to do a bit of a photo shoot and a bit of videoing this time, which will be really nice. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We've been getting stuck into the trout locally at the moment, but it's always nice to have a little tropical escape.
Well, I'll let you know, I don't go to many exotic locations. I went to Hawaii on a family holiday and chased bonefish, saw some huge ones in on the flats in sort of chest to waist-deep water where they see you. I have never experienced fish like it. They were 10-pound plus, and they all had PhDs from Honolulu University, maybe in the skinny water around the airport and whatnot. They're more of an option, but they were incredibly aware of their surroundings and obviously had been fished for a lot. But it was great just to spot them, and particularly that mirror trick that they have. You know, they're over the turtle grass, so they're bright green. Then they're over the sand, and they're bright silver. And then they're going away from you, and they're jet black. And just an extraordinary fish. That they're almost like Wonder Woman's invisible jet.
Yeah, they are an amazing fish, the bonefish, and I guess highly sought after by saltwater fly fishermen all around the world. And Hawaii, I've not fished for them there, but I do know that they're quite educated there, and that there are some really big ones there.
Yeah, they're all over 5 or 6 pound. They were really, really phenomenal fish, and the locals eat them too. They like to eat. They eat everything. But Christmas Island's a different story, I believe. It's a little bit easier than that. Not that they're ever easy.
Yeah, Christmas Island, the bonefish are probably the easiest option there. You will find big schools of them at times, and it can be, to be honest, quite easy to catch them in Christmas Island. Like a lot of guys these days enjoy the bonefish, but they might particularly go and hunt for the big ones in certain locations and certain flats. And the triggerfish has become quite an obsession for a lot of people going there as well.
They're like a leather jacket on steroids. Tell us about catching triggerfish, because they're a beautiful-looking thing, but a strange-looking thing with the teeth and all.
Yeah, they've got that somewhat comparison of being beautiful and quite ugly at the same time. But it's they're a funny fish, but they're quite honest. If you put in a good cast and you don't spook them, they'll track your fly all the way in and kind of tip on it and decide maybe they don't want it. Then you pull it a little bit more and they'll track it again. And they're almost this little riddle that you've got to work out. But they're cool. You walk in the flats, you see this big colourful tail poke out of the water as they dig into the coral to eat something. And yeah, particularly sort of shrimp flies and crab flies get the job done there. And we really like chasing them. The moment you hook one, they're straight back into their little coral hole. You can't let them run at all. And they're quite strong little nuggets.
How big can they get over there?
I mean, 7-8 kilos is quite likely. I'm sure they've been caught bigger. We had a pretty big one on the last trip. Probably a hard thing to gauge their weight because they're quite circular and thick. And a lot of fish we normally catch would be sort of elongated, and you kind of get a thought in your mind of how much they might weigh. But, imagine sort of like 8 kilos could be sort of what they get up to. And they'll probably get even bigger out on the reef as well. But when you've got that fish that has that big burst of run and wants to go into their coral hole at the moment they're hooked there, and their teeth can snap the line, and even the strength of their jaw often breaks your hook in half, they're a really tough little critter.
And they take well to catch and release, so they release well?
Yeah, they're very hardy fish. Yeah, they're a good one in that regard.
So a very sustainable resource, as are the bonefish over there. It's a wonderful thing, that exchange of money from Australian fisher folk to the battling guides in Christmas Island. I think we're talking a lot about diplomacy in the Pacific. This is one way to do it, isn't it, Josh?
Oh, definitely. For Christmas Island, there's probably on average 40 to 60 anglers going to the island a week to fish, and that's a huge input to the economy there. And I mean, all the guides would say it's the best job on the island if you can become a consistent guide for one of the lodges. And yeah, they rely on the tips as well. And I guess we're very clear with the clients we take that there is a tipping culture there. And Australians aren't quite used to that, but it's just part of the program. And we have a lot to give and they have very little. So it makes a big difference to hand over a bit of extra cash at the end of the day. And definitely you see the guides appreciating that. And you see how much money and joy it has brought to the island, just seeing the people being able to catch fish there. And the island recognised that early. Like, they banned netting for bonefish to sustain the fishing. And I guess people get a lot more benefit out of catching the bonefish several times than killing it once.
Yes, it's really the money goes around, doesn't it? And it was wonderful to talk to those guides who came out to Tasmania being kitted out in warm gear and big chest waders. And they just had a delightful time. They're such nice people, and that cultural exchange is fantastic. Well, tight lines, Josh, you're a wonderful ambassador for Australia, and keep catching those exotic fish.
Oh, cheers, Scott. Thanks for the chat.
We'll put up a great photo of Josh holding one of these big Christmas Island triggerfish too. They're a bizarre and beautiful looking critter. He's pretty trigger happy, I think, in the photo too. It's a beauty. He's got a big grin, and the fish swims off none the worse for wear.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Bushy on the south coast is pretty happy too, because the warm water's coming, and I hear reports from way up north, Bushy, that the whiting are starting to respond to the popper fishing that you love in the shallows of your estuaries. It's probably not there yet, but not long to wait now, I wouldn't think.
No, the whiting will be turning up, that's for sure, and I love catching them, but it's just been great the last couple of weeks. The water's formed up down here, and people are catching snapper. They've been really good the last couple of weeks, which is great. You know, everyone loves catching a snapper, and a lot of the guys are using floating baits, that sort of thing, going up to Montague Island and floating baits down with a little T-sinker, which, as you know, is a lot of fun because they usually hit those floaters at 100 mile an hour. So, it's you have a ball, and some nice snapper there at the moment.
heaps better than using a quarter pound lead and dragging them up from the depths. It's great sport on light stuff and light soft plastics as well. And I'm getting reports from up around the Northern Rivers that the whiting are really starting to smash the poppers. So there must be looking up for a feed. You love doing that, don't you? There's so many so many estuaries where that happens on the south coast too. Talk us through getting ready for that, some of the lures and some of the techniques.
Yeah, I'll be keen. We need a bit more temperature here. Well, probably the same temperature as up north. We just get it a little bit later, I guess. But, yeah, I love getting the whiting on the poppers. It's something for years we didn't realise occurred because we just thought whiting were a thing that wandered along the bottom and snuck a few worms and pippies out of the sand. But now we realise they're pretty aggressive species. It's good fun. A lot of them, not so much poppers now. They're more zigzagging lures. So you get a lot of the little zigzagger type things that really catch them, and that's part of it. You need a lure that gets offline, that just goes side to side. That really works well.
Do you use the rod tip action to give it the walk the dog?
Yeah, you've got to do that. It's a little bit like walk the dog on the bass, but if you've multiplied that by about four times as fast, because you're going pretty quick. I mean, we're buying reels now that are 6-to-1 to try and get the retrieve speed, which you need. So yeah, it's a bit bizarre if you haven't done much of it, because you're chucking as far as you can down the breeze, and then you're zigzagging those little lures back, squirting water all over the place. It's a bit more like you're trying to catch a GT only on a smaller lure. And these whiting go nuts. You know, you pull three or four up at a time, and they're all over the lure trying to get hooked. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. And when you do get one, of course, it's pretty good to eat.
Well, there's a tip going really fast, because a lot of us use them for bass, although I generally fly fish for bass, but I've chucked them for brim, and you go wine, jiggle, you know, with the rod tip down, the rod tip to the side, you're giving that little wiggle of the hand, the little wrist action, and then pausing it or doing it slowly, making it go boom, 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 stop, and the whiting, it's flat out.
Yeah, it's a different ball game with the whiting. As I say, we're using 6-to-1 reel, so you can get the speed you need. And it's funny, you'll be... I suppose a couple of tips. You can use a bit bigger lure when it's blowing a little bit harder. You know, probably an ideal wind's probably only about 6 or 8 knots. Perfect. You get that nice fishing ripple. But if it gets a bit windier, you can use a little bit bigger lure. You might go up to a sort of a 60 mil long lure instead of a 50, maybe even a bit bigger. And that makes a bit more fuss so the fish can find it. And fast, yeah, just keep whooping it, and don't make the mistake of stopping or slowing down when they come up behind it either, because they usually just fade off. So you just got to keep your normal retrieve going, and they'll get it. I suppose one of the tricks is most of the guys that are keen replace the rear treble with what we call them danglers. It's just two single hooks tied on a bit of braid, and maybe a couple of strands of rubber on there just to make it a little bit attractive, and that works really well. You can buy them, you know, people... so you can retrofit them, most tackle stores that have them. So that makes a difference. You get a much better hookup on the single hook than you do on a treble.
They also don't weed up as much. There's a lot of weed on the flats where I fish, in the estuary where I fish, and I tend to use those upward-facing ones too that don't catch the weed all the time. It's a good modification.
Yeah, I guess it's also you've got to be on it and search out the places where you don't get too much weed too, because it's pretty frustrating if you get anywhere that you get a lot of floating weed. It's a bit of a write-off, really, for lure fishing, because all you're doing is gardening all the time. So you've really got to look for your areas where you know there's not so much weed. And any estuary, you'll find areas with less weed. Just concentrate on those ones.
Isn't it fascinating, too, in your lifetime, you were one of the pioneers to particularly your black brim, but yellowfin brim as well, elevate them to a sports fishing, lure and fly fishing proposition, and to see the humble whiting become a sports fishing proposition as well, although we're eating a lot of them, but that's okay. That's a great thing to see, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think it's fantastic. And I suppose it's probably not as efficient way to catch them as with a decent bait, like a really good bait fisherman's going to outfish the...
Oh, yeah, put a bloodworm out there and come on. But this is better for the environment anyway, because we're not digging bloodworms out of the sandbanks.
That's the thing. It's just such a fun thing. You've got fish chasing your surface. Not too many anglers around that don't like some fish trying to crash a lure off the surface. And they're enthusiastic, and they're fast. These whiting are fast. You'll be cranking this thing in flat out on a 6-to-1 reel, and sometimes they're mad, these fish. They come cruising up behind it and just pass it, do a couple of loop-to-loops, and then they might bite it.
They're
a really quick fish.
I do it a lot out of the kayak, not because I couldn't wade, but some of the coastal estuaries that I fish, the lagoons, lend themselves to a quick paddle in the kayak. You might only be in ankle waist-deep water max, but the noise they make too, particularly on a quiet night when they're really coming up and crashing your surface lure, and they'll be actually sucking, kissing it. You know, it's a really, really loud noise, particularly reverberating off the hull of the kayak. And you know straight away it's the wayang. You know straight away it's the whiting when you hear that. You know, you really hear it. You really hear it, don't you? They come up and they suck on the surface. It's amazing when they're on it.
Yeah, they definitely keen. So, yeah, we'll be looking forward to that down here shortly, when it warms up tomorrow. And the guys up the North Coast will be right into it pretty well all year. I think you've got pretty good temperatures up there all year.
Yeah. I think they just can't resist it. It just triggers them, even if the big prawns aren't skipping across the top. But that was always my theory. But they catch them before the prawns are that size. So I don't know. It's just something that turns them on. Hey, Bushy, tight lines. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on surface poppering for whiting. And the snapper are on at Bermagui. That sounds pretty good.
That is good. Okay, mate. See you next time.
Tight lines. Catch you then on the big fish. Maybe we'll see him on the banks of the wandering stream.
Mountains rise through endless skies, and the birds sing of bright angel dreams. I've seen the light in the cold rushing water, and it shows me the way to the church of the wandering stream. Cast all your troubles far from the shore. Find yourself lost in a world far from lonely, where catching a rainbow is better than gold. Where mountains rise through endless skies, and the birds sing a bright angel dreams. I've seen the light in the cold rushing water, and it shows me the way to the church of the wandering stream.
Church of the Wandering Sea. on The Big Fish. Coming up next, Stinker talking about big fish from little boats. Coming up on The Big Fish.
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, guys. Scott, how are you?
I'm very well. I don't know if this is a question for polite conversation, but what's the biggest one you've ever caught? How big was it?
Mulloway, probably. Oh, gee, 40 kilo. A 40 kilo mulloway is a big fish, you know. And I caught one, going back a bit now, but I did get a big cobia one time too that was close to that. But that was fishing off the rocks. That took me 3 hours to catch that thing. Oh, gee. The biggest fish would be the mulloway, I should think. And he was a real battler too. It was in Stink Pot with a mate, Duffy. I fish regularly with Duffy in Stink Pot. When imagine there's not a real lot of room in there. It's 11 foot long, Stink Pot, with a 9-horsepower motor. And you know what? If you've got two people in an 11-foot tinny with a 9-horsepower motor, you can go like a rocket. You go far faster than you need to go. But, that fish was a whopper. It was a whopper, Scott.
With someone in the boat with you when you're catching a fish like that, what does a passenger do?
Get out of the road. Make sure he gets out of the road. Wind his line in. And be prepared to help you with the gaff or a torch, you know, whatever. But really, you can pretty much do it all yourself. But on this particular occasion, when I fished seriously for mulloway with a live yellowtail on 50-pound line straight under the boat, and I'd burly up about half an hour before sundown and then wait again probably for another hour and a half after sunset, and then you'd wait. And you'd have your rod set up in a holder at 45 degrees, leaning out over the side of the boat, and the yellowtail dancing around in about 60 foot of water, and you'd ladle over your burley, which would go straight to the bottom, and you knew that it wasn't far away that a big jewfish would be, and then when on that night, I remember it as plain as day, we were sitting there, Duffy and I talking, looking at the moon, and wow. This rod, which takes some bending in yourself just to try and bend the rod yourself because it's like a broomstick. Well, it went into a semicircle and the reel started to squeal and the line's ripping off. And I said to him, this is a very big fish, Duffy. I said, we're in for the ride of our life. But what we didn't expect to happen was what happened next. And that is, and this is quite odd, the fish had such power and my reel was so tight, the drag I'd set pretty tight, the tension was so much that it pulled my anchor. My anchor mustn't have been held on by too much. It must have just been on a lip, on a rock. Well, the power of the fish lifted the anchor off the boat and we took off. Holy man. Off we went. And Duffy said, I think we're moving. I said, I think we are too. Well, off we went. The fish just sort of dragged us around for a while.
And over the gunnels and into the boat, I've got a theory, particularly for close inshore and estuary fishing. The smaller the boat, the bigger and more fish you catch. The bigger the boat, the less fish you catch. It's just from experience of seeing what happens on the water, particularly in the summertime. Well, what are your theories about that?
There's probably a reason for that. And I've exposed it in Stink Pot on many occasions because I can get to places where others who have far bigger boats can't get anywhere near. And big fish get into real shallow water at times. So I can get in there in Stink Pot and I can fish in areas where bigger boats, and they do it, they've got to sit 100 metres off because they don't want to take big boats into shallow water, which is understandable. But Stink Pot, it doesn't care. Oh dear, oh dear! It's very, very exciting fishing. Very exciting. I've had a few interesting experiences. One of the biggest problems with a small boat, if you can get along reasonably quickly, is that, and you don't intend to, but you catch a wave. Oh, I can tell you.
Do a bit of surfing.
Yeah. Well, that brings all your senses to attention. Your eyes poke out like crab's eyes and the hair's blowing back and your knuckles are gone white and you're hanging onto the tiller and you're flying along. And you, the first thing you can do is try and get off it. Or you can, if it's not going to break, you can enjoy the thrill. As long as the nose doesn't poke down, you can enjoy the thrill. And really, it would be, it's one of them that no one has done it, really, in a little tinny. But, I mean, if you tip it over, your motor's gone. But, gee, it's exciting. I've only ever done it twice, and that was a mistake. So I'm not encouraging people to do it, but it was quite a thrill, I can assure you.
Have you ever dipped the gunwale under on occasions or the nose under on occasion?
I've had a couple of mishaps on the Fingal Spit. And it's quite a unique landform for those who don't know it. It leads to a tide island. So from the mainland to the island, it goes underwater at high tide at certain times of the year, and the waves will wash through it. But if you can get through there, it saves a lot of travel. It's a shortcut. That's what it is. And I caught one of my waves coming through there, and went straight through a bunch of surfers. They were real happy. Actually, they all yelled and hooted. And it was great. But, on two occasions, I've been going through there and my prop has got stuck in the sand. Well, that's something else you don't want to happen, especially if there's a wave chasing you. What you do is you need to get on the back of a wave and chase the wave in. So the wave's in front of you, and you're motoring along behind the wave. Now, that's all well and good. But if your prop, if it's very shallow sand and your prop gets stuck in it, well, then there's another wave coming. And it goes over the top, fills up your boat, and there you are. But luckily the water's shallow, so you get out. You get out of your boat, lift your motor, and then
push it over.
Over to, yeah. No one saw it.
It's a tempting shortcut, isn't it? You've got to either go right around Fingal Island or sneak through there. The same thing on Broughton Island, that fisherman's passage that we went through at high tide in Stinkbug, which is a little bit bigger, the 16-foot boat. That's for not for the faint-hearted because, you know, a bit of swell and shallow bottom, but that cuts off half the island too, doesn't it?
Oh, that's a big shortcut, that one. And it's only experience. If you get someone who really knows what they're doing to show you what to do, and I'm always respectful. I mean, I always know plan B. There's always a plan B. But it's not too, it might look a bit dodgy, but it's not too bad if you've got things under control. But as I said, a couple of times over all the years I've been fishing out of Stinkpot, which is, I think, 35 years, I've rowed home twice and I've been drenched twice and I've caught waves twice. So that's about, in 35 years, that's not too bad.
That's not too bad. That's a pretty good safety record. I remember the photo you sent me of a giant speedboat up on the rocks at Fingal Island and you're in Stinkpot right next to it. Indicating that maybe some people have had a few issues around that area, but it's always a risk, you know. But it's a calculated risk, hopefully, plan C is probably a life jacket and to know how to swim because we can all come to grief, can't we?
Oh, look, that's for sure. Don't ever think that you've got the sea mastered. If you think you've got control of the sea, well, it's about time you went and played golf because there's no way in the world you can do that. It's very, very
unpredictable. With the way you hit the golf ball, Stinker, I'm going to stick to the sea because I'd end up topping one right in the temple. Hey. Sorry.
I remember one yarn. I went out there once. I'm in a hurry. And that's the worst thing you can be, Scott, is in a hurry because you always forget something. I've been out there and forgotten the fishing rod. And I'll be out there and forgotten.
Yeah, because you've got to get out. You've got to get going. You're on a tight schedule.
You've got to go. The sun's fading. Yeah, quick. Everything's quick. Well, I went out there one time, roared out. I'm about 50 metres out, and the motor starts to splutter on all the ground. And I'd left my petrol tank back at the service station. I had no petrol. It was just in what was in the hose. So I did a Yui, and I just got back to the beach as it went splat. For the last time, you know?
Oh, dear. Everyone's done that. And, of course, the bungs. You've got to remember the bungs.
Oh, dear. Of everything, whether it be a big boat or a little boat or anything at all, the most important part is that little rubber plug. And that's your bung. And if you don't put that in, well, off you go to King Neptune.
That's the way. Hey, tight line stinker.
Hooray, mate.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
It's The Big Fish, and we really rely on technology to bring this show to you, particularly some of the worst mobile phones in the world, because they've all had a bath.
Splish, splash, I was taking a bath, long about a Saturday night.
Saturday morning, The Big Fish and IT guru Digital Dave Abrahams and Fisher Person.
Yo.
Joins me in the studio, fishing buddy of mine. G'day, Dave.
G'day, Scott. How are you doing?
Like a dollar for every time we've lost a correspondent of The Big Fish because their phone has taken a bath. It's at the bottom of the ocean.
There's a lot of them. The anthropologists of the future, Scott, will be fascinated. What are those things?
And Stinker's phone, it's all gummed up with mullet gut and bits of pilchards and all the rest of it. We'll talk about phones taking a bath, because you've got some very interesting research on that. But Dave's married to a wonderful Norwegian woman and spends half his year in Norway fishing, walking, camping,
fishing grass roofs, you know, whatever I throw
but
my hand.
But the fishing up there, it's another world for Australians, isn't it? Tell us about some of your fishing adventures on the Arctic char, the giant Barndor halibut, the huge cod, the invasive giant crabs. That's a story, isn't it?
I mean, here we're talking about from 60 degrees further north right up to, 80 degrees. So we're talking about equivalents of being on the coast of Antarctica. I mean, that's how far Norway is.
Really?
That's a good way to look at it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Norway lives effectively on the coast of Antarctica. And then the beautiful thing, that's all linked to the Gulf Stream. And the Gulf Stream holds the whole of Northern Europe not under ice. And basically the ice ages in Europe happen because the Gulf Stream slows, the energy from the tropics stops, and therefore a huge layer of ice just settles on the top.
But you have those ice age throwbacks like the Arctic char, which are the most amazing fish. You've caught those
and they
on
taste.
Fly, haven't you?
Well, I catch them every year. My wife's family has a lovely little farm, and it looks south, and it's about 10 kilometres long, a few little islands and skerries on the whole thing. However, it is one of the lakes that actually has the Arctic
char. So this farm's on the lake?
Yeah, right on the lake. So we just pull out the old wooden boat, we go for a fish, and you can fly fish or you can lure fish, you can net, because we've got licences to net it, because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
So many of them. And you pull
so it's
them.
A balanced fishery. Absolutely. So that's sustainable.
Norway, they're good at balancing their fisheries. I mean, we are total rubbish, but down over there, they worked out in the 50s after they almost killed their entire herring population that what you need to do is scientifically control your fisheries. Of course, fish in Norway is a massive industry. Cod alone is, I think it's the fourth largest export in a country which has a lot of exports, topping with oil and gas and electricity and so on. And fish is massive.
Tons of cod there.
Huge amounts.
Watched YouTube clips, and you've done this.
Yep.
You've gone down to the field with a rod, thrown it in and caught a giant cod.
You don't need a rod.
And you can do it straight off the land.
You don't need a rod. I mean, seriously, you can pick up a bit of old fishing line you find.
Like a hand line.
And you bung a few things, not just one. You never, ever put just one hook on.
Right. You might find a few seabird feathers and lash them to a hook.
And you put a sinker on it, straight down, And you get these big, floppy, beautiful fish that sacrifice themselves for the good of mankind. It's
and you
wonderful.
Eat the wonderful cod, which is a magnificent fish to eat, the cold water cod, which has really been decimated in the UK and other
Absolutely.
Parts of the...
But the Norwegian cod, of course, is because of their sustainable fisheries, is wonderfully a wonderful resource. They dry them. They sell them off to all through
Spain and Italy,
Spain,
yeah, they
and
love
Italy
it.
And so on. And
in the Middle
that's
East.
Big money. It's
yeah,
big
the
money.
The dried cod.
Huge money.
What about the barned or halibut and the other flatfish? They get great flounder and halibut too, don't they?
You may remember
catch those just for the hell of it.
You may remember your old correspondent in Ian Burt, and he was my guide when he was up there. This mad Scotsman who was a great fisherman, you know, and he designed lures and everything. He went out and he would show us out at a place called Lofoten where these islands that extend into the Atlantic. And it's incredible size of these fish. Now, I didn't pull one up myself, but you go into a quay and there was the outline, the profile of the fish that people had caught during
the
season.
So they draw a tracing of the halibut. They call them barn doors,
well, they
don't
are
they?
Quite literally, some of them are quite literally bigger than barn doors. They are remarkable fish.
We're talking about 100 kilo plus.
Yep. Yeah, and it would fill the studio basically. We'd be under it. we'd be gagging. I mean, they're big,
they're
big
monsters.
Fish. And of course, the roving killer whales that come and go and hunt these things.
Yeah, right.
At certain depths. And you see them come up when the halibut come up and they'll take a bite out of it, or you can just watch them do their various things.
And they used
quite incredible.
Round up the herring too with bubble nets.
Yeah.
Do they still do that, or the herring runs have come back?
Oh, the herring runs have come back in certain parts of the country.
Yeah.
There's some controversy there because of what's called 3D or 2D seismic testing, and I bumped into a Norwegian who happened to be in Adelaide fighting the seismic testing in the Great Australian Bight.
Oh, right.
Because he's saying if you do this 3D testing, which is very high pressured explosions under the sea at the same time from various different levels to get a three-dimensional picture of what's underneath the surface of the sea.
The seabed, yeah.
It kills fish, plankton, everything. And he's coming around the world and he's saying, guys, don't do it because it'll knock your fisheries out for a couple of years, even more. And he's a fisherman and an economist and a fascinating story in its own right. We'll have to talk about that. But these are the outside of that, they're very wealthy fisheries and they're worth a fortune.
And they look after them. And
by and large,
tourists can go and have a crack.
By and large,
it's a great place to go and catch a feed of fish, by the sound of it. But also these invasive king crabs, this mad Russian experiment that's gone crazy. It's
They're the Pacific, crabs. And
yeah, the giant ones that are in the Deadliest Catch. Yeah,
absolutely. They're the ones.
And so the Russians have a Pacific coast as well as an Atlantic coast. Brought them in and put them in fields above.
A little bit over towards Novaya Zemlya, which is just next to Norway.
And where they went like cane toads.
Where all the nuclear subs are.
Yeah.
And they placed them in there, distributed them, and now it was a massive problem. But of course, in the Norwegian style, they've said, you know what? We can't fight it. Let's make it as a resource. And now they're using it as a resource, and it's a very popular
But they're
resource.
In the fjords. I was
the
reading
Northern
about
fjords, yeah.
tourism where people go to a frozen fjord, stay in a log cabin, go out on a skidoo, and dig a hole. They get a chainsaw and auger a hole, and then drop a trap down and fill it up full of king crabs, and you go back and you boil them and you eat fresh crab
Absolutely.
Around the fire.
Best
I mean,
to do in the winter, too.
Beautiful. How good's that?
Look, it's remarkable, and who knows? I mean, they're a bit worried about what they're doing with the ecosystem on the bottom of the fjord, because they're probably wiped out.
They have regulations for them now, so they must have got it under control.
Well,
because it's a regulated fishery, whereas
it is now.
If you just wanted to take as many as you could, that might be a solution. But they're actually regulating it.
Well, you know,
maybe
regulating's
got a bit
a good
of a balance.
Idea. Yeah. Regulating's a good idea. If you can't, you need to use science to and pull in the fishermen and women to use it in a responsible fashion. I mean, this is great protein. It's great tasting. It's great tourism.
Yeah.
It's great. So I was impressed by that particular story. And there are other invasive things that are happening around there. Of course, the escapees.
Oh yeah, the salmon farming is not
is
popular.
A big
yeah.
deal. You know, mixing the genetics between the farm salmon and the wild salmon is a massive issue.
Yeah.
And a very, for the Norwegians who love their salmon fishing, it is a very emotive issue.
Opening day over there is a national holiday. Anyway, down to the issue at hand, because you're also our IT guru, people dropping their phone in the ocean or down the toilet bowl, but mainly in the water when you're a fisher person. You pull it out on the kayak and it drops into the kayak well or something.
How many times? She's
gone. Is it gone, though?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, first of all, to put it in, I mean, I crunch numbers. I look at the analytics. I have a look at the data. Now, 2 years ago, IDC, which is the International Data Corporation, did a big thing in the UK and said, how many phones every year are damaged through water? And it blew us all away because it was 10% per annum, actually 11% per annum.
Well, amongst listeners to this program, The Big Fish, it's probably 94%. Well, so how do we fix it?
Well, I mean, the thing is to realise it's such a massive industry. I mean, in Australia has 26 million mobile devices by the end of this year. That's what we'll have. Exactly, 20 million mobile users. So work that out, like, you know, which is no surprise when you look at everything from kindergartens to bus stops. There's a lot of phones. So we're saying that about 2.6 million phones are damaged through water in Australia every year. Now, this is a big industry. I talked to some of the repairing industry people and saying, hey, listen, it's approximately about $250 on an average fix. The big deal, of course, most people come in and they say their whole lives are on their phones. Yeah. That is to say their bank apps, their wonderful fishing shots, their text messages.
No one will believe you. No one will believe you.
But the biggest thing you can do is make sure you back your phone up all the time, because it's really not the phone which is the love affair. It's all the data, the photos, the apps and so on and so forth that you have. So whatever you do as fisher folk, back your phone up. If you're using Apple or Google, use their cloud backup if you feel like it, or plug it into your computer and back it up. Because basically 50% of the time, once these phones are dropped in the water, they're gone, right? So what you want is you can abandon a phone, but you can't abandon all those memories and wonderful things. So the first thing to do is actually basically back it up all the time. Have it automated.
Fishing.
All the time. It's a big deal.
Well, if you're trying to save it, though, if you're trying to rescue it, take us through the tips.
Well, going through and talking to the industry and getting online, I mean, it's a massive industry. It's worth in Australia at least $300 million a year in repairs. And this just for water damage. This isn't for other damage. So it's a big industry, and there's some really good people. In fact, there's some wonderful people we hope to bring on the program at one stage to talk about that. But the advice that they've given me is, first, don't shake it. Pick it out of the phone. Don't shake it. Put it on an absorbent towel, flat. Don't try and do things with it. Turn the phone off as soon as possible. And the reason there is, first of all, the don't shaking is you'll just distribute water inside the phone if you start shaking it. So don't do that. Put it flat, and then turn the phone off, because a live phone corrodes copper circuits much more than a phone that has no electricity going through it. So turn it off and don't try and turn it on again for a while. This is important. If you can take the covers off, some of the phones allow you to take the covers off. That's all very well. You can, here's a tip that I got from our local expert, is use a vacuum cleaner gently to try and suck the water out. So no dabbing and shaking and carrying on like that. Suck as much water out as you possibly can. Don't plug the charger in either, because that will short circuit the whole thing. Now, the rice thing is a bit of a a weird myth that has some truth to it. However, the great repairers around
dry rice, not boiled rice.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Stinker tried boiled rice.
Yeah, mate, Stinker, mate. What you want to do is this: collect, instead of rice, because rice actually has carbohydrates in it. Mm-hmm. They say if it actually gets into the phone, the dust will actually short circuit it more. So if you do that, make sure that the rice has no dust in it. However, here was a wonderful tip. All of those electronic devices we've all bought over the years all have that silica gel packet.
So do pill bottles. Yeah. If you buy any, I collect them.
Collect them.
I've got tons of them. Well, Ronnie collects them.
Make sure you put them in the oven, dry them out. Oven at a low temperature, dry them out.
So if you know one who takes lots of pills,
put
they,
them in.
They are gold.
They are gold for mobile phones and for fisher folk.
I use them in the tackle boxes. I use them in my fly boxes. You stick them in and with your, all your gear, and they absorb the moisture so your gear doesn't rust. It's a very good tip. So
use those. And there is also active carbon, which is sold in some health food shops that actually absorbs moisture very quickly as well. So
good on you, Dave. And, of course, befriend a hypochondriac if you want all of those absorbent things from the pill bottles. That's our lot for the big fish. We'll catch you next time. Tight lines.